about something in light of that song we just sang about when we leave our children here. And it'll be their turn, and our grandchildren's turn, and our great-grandchildren's turn to run that race. And as we study these topics on the family, I want you to think about making generational impacts. There's a fellow in the book of Jeremiah. His name, he was the father of the Rechabites. And to make a point, God said to call the Rechabites and have them drink wine, and they came and they refused to. And then they explained that their father had told them there were just several standards they were going to have in that family. They were not going to live in the cities. They were not going to drink wine and that type of thing. And there was somebody in that family that had just had a multi-generational impact. I want you to think about a legal pad. If you write on the front of a legal pad, everybody can see what you wrote. If you write firmly enough and make a deep enough impression, you can turn the page and you can see exactly what was written. If you made a deep enough impression, you can turn the next page and maybe the next page and see what was written. If we don't take our tasks seriously, if we try to cozy up with the world and not stand firmly with the Lord, and be busy with too many other things and not focused on training our children, there's not going to be a very deep impression from page to page, generation to generation. The more deeply we have that emphasis and that focus, the more pages it will carry through to. Our personal impact will still diminish as those pages go away. How many of you know the names of your great-grandparents or your great-great-grandparents? Sometimes we don't even know their names. Some of you do. But let's be establishing generational patterns within our own families for our children and our grandchildren so that as we leave them here, we've left them with a good foundation. We're talking about child training. Proverbs 22:6 again, the verse we start with each night. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he's old, he will not depart from it. We've been talking about parenting pitfalls. The first night, we talked about these. The second night, we talked about these. Tonight, we're going to finish up with a few more, and they are as follows. Mistake number 13, thinking if we don't allow this, they might rebel and leave the church. You ever heard parents say that? Maybe somebody talks to somebody, you're going to let him do that? Well, he really wants to. I know it's not good, but if we say no, he might rebel and leave the church. You're going to let her wear that? Well, I don't think she should. You're going to let him participate in that? Well, it's not what I wanted, but if we say no, they might rebel and leave the church. What good is being in the church when we're not in the Lord? There's just no point in that at all. Look at Revelation chapter 3, verse 14. The church at Laodicea had been started by Epaphras. We know, I believe, he's referred to over in Colossians. We know that at the same time Paul wrote to the Colossians, he had also written to the Laodiceans. But by the time the book of Revelation is written, that church had deteriorated. And in verse 14, this is what the Lord said. The angel, this is Revelation 3:14, to the angel of the church in Laodicea write, these things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I would that you were cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spew you out of my mouth. Were these people still in the church there at Laodicea? They were in the church. Were they in the Lord? No, they weren't. Part of being in the Lord is not forsaking the assembling of the saints, coming together with brothers and sisters, singing, worshiping, hearing the word together, observing the Lord's Supper together. That's part of it. But that's not all of it. It's a little bit like a football huddle. You get together, you remember what you need to do, and then you got to go out there and do it. If we get to the point that we're just trying to keep our children in the pews, that's not where they need to be. They need to be in the Lord. If they're in the Lord, they'll want to be in the pews. This is such a poor mentality. In James chapter 4, verse 4, James writes, the brother of Christ, he says, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God?" How many times have you seen young people who are pretty good kids, and they start getting in their teenage years, and they start getting really interested in that, really interested in this, and sometimes it may not be something absolutely wrong. Maybe they're getting infatuated with some particular group of musicians or something. Well, you know, if they're musically inclined or they like, you know, this band or this song, that's not necessarily a problem. But, you know, when you start seeing something's amiss here, when they start wanting to listen to music with trashy lyrics, when that starts to be what they're obsessed with, when they're not really interested in the Apostle Paul, but they're really interested in that bass drummer, you know, and something's out of kilter there. When things are in their right priority and we can enjoy other things that are innocent and appropriate in their place, that's fine. But when they become to be an obsession, and then it begins to take them into the world in things that are not good, and in the middle of, say, you know, concerts where you have lots of drugs going on and this and that and this lifestyle and that lifestyle, and the posters are going up in the room, and the friends that they're hanging out with and horrible T-shirts that they're wearing, and mom and dad think, well, it's a phase. Well, that particular phase of their phase may be a phase, but it's also a road in the wrong direction. And we need to keep them on the straightened, narrow way rather than the path of destruction. Romans chapter 12, please turn there. The book of Romans, fantastic book. The first 11 chapters deals with the concept of salvation and why we need it, and how it is accomplished and how it's not accomplished. And after discussing the mercies of God and how that works over the 11 chapters, he turns then to the practical application. He says in chapter 12, verse 1, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God," these mercies that he's been talking about in the preceding chapters, "present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service." Focus with me, please, on verse 2. "Be not fashioned according to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Jesus calls us to be lights to the world. Sometimes Jesus talks about how the world is in darkness. I want you to think of the contrast between light and darkness. If all the power were to suddenly go off in this building right now, and it was late at night, and so there was no sunlight coming in, all the power was off, and one person in here had a flashlight, and they pulled it off and turned it on, would you be able to see it? Would there be any question where it was? That would stand out. We need to look different from the world. We need to talk differently, behave differently. There needs to be a difference. Far too many people are wearing the name of Christ, but they're dressed in world camouflage, just fitting in and blending in. And evangelistically, is that wanting to bring people to Christ? It may be bring people to a place where you can be lukewarm and act like the world, but if you want to talk about making a difference in people's lives, have you ever seen those commercials where they're advertising a laundry detergent and they show, you know, the child's soccer jersey or whatever after it's gotten all stained up, and they said, you know, I sent it through and washed it with Ultra Tide just one time, and now look at it. Why do they do that? To show you, you should buy this detergent because look at the difference it can make. It went from filthy to sparkling clean. To make this point, one time in South Carolina, I took a shirt and I just rubbed it in some sand and dirt and ashes and got it just filthy. And I got up and before the sermon, I said, listen, I said, we were at the wholesale club the other day and I bought a lot of detergent. And I just want to mention this in case anybody wants some. It's great, great stuff. If you want some, you know, just let me know. I said, let me show you how good it is. And I pulled out that T-shirt. This is what a T-shirt looked like before I used these super socks. And I said, let me show what it looked like afterwards. I pulled up the same T-shirt. And most people knew it was an illustration, but one fellow thought I was, you know, offering detergent. He said, wait a minute. He said, that's after you washed it? And I said, yeah. You want to buy that detergent? Well, of course he didn't. Who would want to buy that detergent if it doesn't make a difference? If people look at our lives, if our neighbors look at our lives, if our coworkers look at our lives, and they don't see a difference, if they see miserable, joyless, self-centered, negative, dishonest, self-seeking people, why should anybody try to get what they've got? It's the same thing lots of other people got. We need to be cleaned up. And the world is constantly, whether it's through the media, whether it's through the fashion, you know, clothing choices available, whether it's through jokes or language or whatever, the world is constantly trying to pull us in and trying to pull our children in. And it is a foolish parent that decides to put their children on loan to the devil for a while and trust that it's a phase. We need to stand for what's right. Our children and we are going to make enough mistakes on our own without throwing in a white flag of surrender. Entertainment, attire, interests, we need to be real careful about what we're thinking about what we're watching, about what we're doing, about what we're reading, about what we're wearing, about language we're using. If they want to live like the devil and we let them, the devil's already got them, whether they're still sitting on a pew or not. And start training early. One thing talked about some of the moms who were having a study earlier today in discussion, and one of the things is if we teach our children only after they're teenagers that you need to have a sense of modesty, something's been missed there. Because if we let them wear almost next to nothing for year after year after year after year, and then say they turn 15 or 16 and say, oh, by the way, now you got to wear clothes. One, they don't understand why the change, and two, we've failed to instill a sense of modesty. Even when they're younger, we can help them start learning that there's things I'm not going to do. There's things I'm not going to engage in. It's not my job to do what everybody else does. It's my job to do what's noble and good. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1. Let's read two texts there, in 1 and 2. Verse 15. Like as he who called you is holy, be ye yourselves also holy in all manner of living. As he who called us is holy, we should be holy in all manner of living. Verse 9. You are an elect race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may, American Standard says, show forth the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We're to show forth the excellencies of God. That's a big job. We're not to show mediocrity. You and I, and our children, if we train them and if they will submit their lives to Christ, we need to be, think about this, walking advertisements of what God can do with a sinful human being. We need to rise above the worldly standards around us. Paul said in Ephesians 4:1, walk worthily of the calling that you've been called to. Number 14, the mistake of going into defense mode when our children are wrong. I imagine we've probably got at least a school teacher or two in here. And if you taught school for a number of years, you've seen a big change in this particular thing. Some years back, what typically happened when a child got in trouble at school? They were going to be in trouble at home. What's become the norm now? With a lot of parents, if their child gets in trouble at school, the parents show up and pitch a fit and blame the teacher. Why are you allowing them to do that? It's almost like they think, and I think there's some people in government that think it is their job to be raising our children. It's not. But I think there's some people who think it's your job. You're supposed to be making them behave. And no, my little boy wouldn't have done that. No. Defending, denying, and redirecting blame. You know, ever since the first sin in Genesis 3, what immediately happened after it? The first excuses and pointing the finger somewhere else. Habit's been around a long time. 1 Timothy 5:21, Paul told Timothy to do things without partiality. If it's somebody else, wrong is wrong and right is right. And if it's my child, wrong is wrong and right is right. And Lucas, sit up. Isaiah 5:20, woe to them that call evil good and good evil. And that's what these parents are doing. If somebody else did it, oh, that would have been bad. But if it's my child, oh, no, he had a reason. He had a reason. And if you start a pattern of bailing them out, don't be surprised if they come to expect it. And don't be surprised if you get the more literal sense of bail them out as well. Number 15. This passage. The rod and reproof bring wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. Correct your son, he'll give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Proverbs 29:15-17. That's a good text. I'm not sure why that slide was there. I think maybe I moved around some things that it got left there. Number 16, underestimating threats. Remember when we talked about threats against our house, like termites, things like that? We take those things seriously. If you've got some faulty wiring in your house, and you go by one wall, and it's always just really hot. You smell a burning smell. You say, yeah, we ought to keep an eye on that. You know, it's probably just a phase. No, we take that seriously. There's a lot of things attacking our homes. Let's just mention a few. Corruption from the entertainment media and the internet. Television has just got, the programs get more and more vulgar, more and more irreverent, more and more debased. And that while there can be some good things on, there's a lot of trash on. Who on the face of the earth should be counted on not to be watching the trash if it's not God's peculiar people? And yet, it's amazing what some brethren will do. I've been places to hold a meeting and show up, you know, at somebody's house for dinner. And there they are, sitting there watching the TV, you know, while some adultery or something is being depicted with people. And they're just sitting there watching it. Some steamy scene. Far too many things. Oh, but it's funny. But if it's trash, it's trash. We talked about internet pornography the other night. If you have children, please, please, please understand how serious this problem is. I've talked with children, dealt with children where I was so bad, if you could go back to a point before they got involved in these things. But once they get involved in them, they can stop, but they have corrupted their minds to an extent and often gotten themselves addicted and often have terrible things happen. And it's a type of thing that can pull a person in deeper and deeper and deeper. I remember one friend, and he'd, first inkling I had of this was when he came to me crying, tears gushing. He's so embarrassed. His wife had found on the phone bill where, again, he had been making those 1-900 calls, if you remember from some years ago. Talking to him on that, and he cried and cried, and he was so sorry. But then just a few years later, I get a call. He's in another city, and now he's up to some of this stuff again. Then a few years later, I get a call, and he's in another state, and he's about to leave his wife. I hear about it. He doesn't call me, but I hear about it. He's about to leave his wife, and he's headed to he's been, his 16-year-old son. You know what his 16-year-old son's job was in the family? To try to keep dad off the internet porn. How sad is that? But now he is, there's some woman that he's talked to or met or something, and he's headed to California. So I called him. And he said, I've got to see where this is going to go. And I told him, your life has not reached the depths yet that it's going to. A few weeks later, he was checked into a mental ward. In a hospital. He eventually came back to his wife. She eventually let him come back. He died the next year. A few days before he died, he was telling a young man, don't waste your life on this stuff like I did. I've known people ending up in jail, causing just horrible hurts and all sorts of things. Please understand. Dads, remember when, if you're my age, remember what it was like to be 13 or 14 and even just a National Geographic, you know, sometimes raise your curiosity. Now imagine just a click away to all sorts, and there's corrupt business people just seeking to pour into these poor young fellas. Understand the danger there. Don't assume. Well, you know, years later, we may have to have a talk about that kind of thing. Years later, you can have a child whose mind is filled and filled with corruption, is already in trouble with the law, or has already, you know, done heinous things and such. Take that threat seriously. Offenders. I'll just give one example of this, and I'll be vague in my description. I've got some friends that run a daycare. And we talked about before, the used to the concept, people understood that children need a parent with them. But we've got a lot of people in society now that, no, the parents can be busy doing other things, making money, and you just pay somebody to watch the children. When you put your child in a daycare situation, you're putting your child with a bunch of other children. And as much perversion as there's going on in our society now, if you've got a group of children, there's a good chance that some of the children have been exposed to perversion. They came to me, and they had a problem. It's a very small daycare. They only had about 8 kids or so. But they walked in, and they found a 6-year-old taking unnatural advantage of a 3-year-old. And this is what, when they went to like their licensing board or over a corporate thing or whatever, when they went to them, this is what they were told. Keep it quiet. How many times do you suppose those licensing boards or corporate heads and stuff have given that advice? Keep it quiet, keep it quiet, keep it quiet. Turns out the 6-year-old was from a family where they had just been babysat by some teenagers who are from a family who's extremely perverted. I won't describe, just because we have a mixed audience, the lifestyle that that family lived, but you see how perversion can go from here to here to here to here? Please understand that there's a lot of wicked people out there. The world is not as innocent a place as it used to be. It never was an innocent place. But these types of corruption have spread it farther, farther, and farther. Protect your children. Just because the world thinks it's okay to trust your children to be here, there, and everywhere without your supervision doesn't mean that it is. Watch your children. Bible contradiction, educational agendas, depending on the school district you're in and such, it can be more or less so. Up in Massachusetts, there was a fellow arrested because his first grader, I believe it was, came home with a book promoting homosexuality. The book was King and King. And in a little cartoon form, it shows, it's a story about a king in love with a king, and it shows them kissing each other, and they're, instead of king and queen, it's king and king. Well, they went down to the school, and they said, when you're doing this particular program, you let us know, and we want our child to be given something else, or we'll just keep him home that day. And the school official said, this is not a parental notification issue. And they insisted, no, you need to notify us when you're going to be doing this. We don't want our children taught this. We don't want you dealing with this with our children. We want to know. And they just insisted, this is not a parental notification issue. And he said, I'm not leaving until we have this understood. They called the police. The police came and handcuffed him and arrested him. It's not the state of Massachusetts, kids. It's that mother and father's kids. But there are people out there that have some different agendas. Presuming a default mode for medication solutions to behavior issues. I just want to mention this. And medication is a rather personal decision. There's a place and a time for medication. Luke was a doctor. Doctors are not bad things. Medication can be a life-saving thing. But I want you to think about something. If you believe that there is a God who in the beginning created man and woman, male and female, he created them, and he gave us laws, and there are things that are right, and there is wrong, and there is sin to be turned from and repented from, and there is a judgment day, you have one view of bad behavior, don't you? If you are an evolutionist, if you're an atheistic evolutionist, is there a God? Is there a day of judgment? Is there sin that's against God's will? What are we? We are accidental arrangements of chemicals. So if I'm an accidental arrangement of chemical and I'm not behaving the way you want me to behave, what seems to be the culprit? My arrangement of chemicals. So what's going to be the solution? By default, change the chemicals, change the chemicals, change the chemicals. And this is a mindset behind, there are certain drugs and such that are prescribed much more in this country than any other country around except Canada. And in our country, we say, oh, this child has this. Oh, this child has that. We got to change their behavior. Give them a drug. Other countries aren't doing it at all at the rate that we are. We need to be careful about those things. There's a time and a place for medication, but not every behavior issue is a medication issue. There's a lot of other things could be said about that. I won't take time to do that now. Feminism agendas and blurring of gender roles. There's a lot of people out there that their agenda is to make sure that your kids are not going to grow up with the religious values that you have. You are considered to be homophobic if you don't approve of homosexuality. You are considered to be superstitious if you do not believe in neo-Darwinian evolution. And you are considered to be a Neanderthal or whatever if you believe that men and women have different roles. And it's their goal, whether on a PBS special or Girl Scouts or whatever, to get your kid to know better than you do on these things. Watch for those things. Declining standards of self-responsibility, dress, conduct, et cetera, et cetera. Don't underestimate the threats. The wise parent realizes the forces out there and keeps tabs on them. The unwise parent just goes through life doing what all their neighbors and cousins do. Then we shouldn't be surprised if we get the same results as our neighbors and our cousins. Number 15, I think we just went from 16 to 15, sorry. Thinking that what they really need is more and more money. I'm just going to mention this briefly. We talked about it back on Sunday morning. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. Our families will be better off if we have more time with our families than if we have less time and more stuff. It's the home, not the house. It's the family, not the stuff. 17, lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. Turn to Luke chapter 10. Excuse me, Luke 15. I want you to think for just a moment before we read this text. How many times you see this pattern? It's not an absolute pattern at all. I've seen some lastborns that behave like firstborns and such. And there can be problems with being firstborn. But if you will think about it, in your family, uncles, aunts, cousins, you know, extended family, friends, families you've been involved with, maybe your immediate family or whatever, how many times have you seen this pattern? Firstborn, sense of responsibility, sense of maturity, gets married, if they choose to get married, holds a marriage together, gets a job, has a rather, you know, successful, dependable career, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what does everybody always expect out of that child? They're going to pay their taxes. They're going to do their work. They're going to keep their marriage together, et cetera. Baby of the family. That's got some problems coming along. Why? Doesn't have to be that way. There's some wonderful, wonderful people that were the last born in their family. Joseph was not the firstborn among those 12 brothers, but he had better character than most of them. Why does that happen? And look at Luke 15. Jesus puts a detail in here that's interesting. Didn't have to be there. which son, now both sons in this story have a problem, but which son is it that wants to grab the money and run off and party? Look at the text. Verse 11, he said, a certain man had two sons. It doesn't say one of them went. It says the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of your substance that falls to me. And he divided unto them his living. Not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took the journey into a far country. There he wasted his substance with riotous living. Now, did the elder son have a problem? Yeah, the elder son had a problem too. He had a bad attitude when his younger brother comes back. Why? You wasted all, you know, you never threw me a party, and I've been here doing what you said, all this. He's had his responsibility, but he's also got a bad attitude, and he doesn't have love for his younger brother, et cetera, et cetera. He's got his set of issues. But I want you to explore with me something about this. Why is that such a tendency? I was in a meeting one time, and a woman was telling me about one of her children. One of the children had a good marriage. You know, they had a good family business, had nice kids, had a nice home, et cetera, et cetera. And the other one was, you know, living over the garage and various issues of irresponsibility, long record of it, et cetera, et cetera. And as she described it, I said, was he your baby, the last born? And a look of shock came over her face, and she said, how did you know? Because it's a common enough pattern. I want to explore for just a few minutes why that may be so. Do you remember when you had your first baby? Do you remember when you took your firstborn home from the hospital? Do you remember how careful you were about everything? If the pacifier fell down on the ground, what did you do? You sterilized it, right? Because you took very gravely the responsibility of having this baby. Oh no, the pacifier fell on the ground. And you, maybe somebody just threw, that's being thrown away. We're getting another one. We're not risking a sterilized Passover pacifier on my baby. But you sterilized that thing before it went back in his mouth. If you had several children, were you still sterilizing the Passover every time it fell on the ground? Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, after, you know, the second one, you know, cold water will do. Third one, fourth one, let the dog lick it off. You know, it's, why? Why? Because we realized we were being needlessly careful. You know, after sterilizing the pacifier and then seeing them eat out of the potted plant or lick the bottom of your shoe, you know, and we realized God made them tougher than that, we realized, oh, you know, okay, they don't die, you know, if they get a germ. And so we do what? We relax. And we realize, oh, the reason the firstborn lived was not because of the sterilized pacifier. But then we do the same thing with behavior. Firstborn comes along, and when they ask for something, they have to say what? Please. When they're given something, they have to say what? Thank you. Are they allowed to be defiant and say no? No. And we train them and train them and train them and train them and get that behavior. And then we look there, and everybody, we got this wonderful little four-year-old or whatever, and people say, oh, what a good boy he is. And then we make a mistake. We think, oh, he lived, so I didn't need to clean the pacifier. Oh, he's turned out to be a great kid. I didn't need to worry about the behavior. You see the difference? Cleaning the pacifier wasn't what made him live. Training him was what made him a well-behaved child. But then we start letting up and letting up and letting up. Here's a couple of other things that happen. When the firstborn comes into the world, how much time, how much of our parenting time do we have to devote to Him? 100%. If you have six, how much time does the last born get? Hopefully more than a sixth, because he's going to need it more, but you've got other kids too. So there's some competition for time. But also, when the firstborn comes into the world, who are his immediate peers? Mom and dad. He comes into a home of nothing but adults. So what behavior does he start to aim for? To be like an adult, to be like an adult, to be like an adult. And oftentimes firstborn are very ambitious and goal-driven and wanting, they're eager to grow up and be an adult. The lastborn comes into a house full of what? Children. And so it's easier to aim where? David, more childish. And that's part of the way it's going to work. Firstborn, how eager were you for him to do each of those little milestones? Did you keep the baby book? Did you mark? Oh, was that a smile? No, it wasn't. But that was a smile, and you wrote it down in the book, right? First tooth, and you wrote it down in the book. First step, oh, you wrote it down in the book. Luke doesn't have a baby book. Nor does Zach. But even if you kept the books, what changes after a while? With that first one, it seemed like forever before it said mama. It seemed like forever before it took its first step. It seemed like forever before you got that smile. It seemed like forever before it was potty trained. But after you had a child or two, you realized what? That went by quick. Then along comes the baby, and mama says what? I don't want this one to grow up too fast. And so, he can stay in a diaper a little longer. That's cute. He can keep a pacifier longer. That's cute. Well, we don't need to push that because I want him to stay a baby for a while. And a while longer. And a while longer. And a while longer. And then he's 35, and he's living in the basement. And the firstborn and the secondborn are saying, why don't you kick him out? And mama says, don't talk about my baby. You see that? Babies are wonderful, wonderful things. We all used to be babies. But it's not very cute for a 35-year-old to be wearing a diaper or a pacifier or living in the basement having mom do his laundry. We need to give our latter-born children the same thing we gave our first-born children. We need to give them love. We need to give them training. We need to enjoy when they're babies. We need to enjoy when they're toddlers. We need to, but we also need to let them grow up and expect them to grow up and train them to grow up, because we're not doing them a service to try to keep a baby for decade after decade after decade. I want to say just a word at the end here about temperament and birth order. This will be the last point. Some of you, no doubt, if you've got several children, you've found out that they come wired a little differently, don't they? You have one child, and they have this personality, another child, they have that personality, and such. And some are pleasers, and some are strong-willed, right? And some are somewhere in between. But if you have several children, a lot of you know what it's like to have a pleaser, right? They just want to please mom and dad. They love to bring mom something and see mom smile or help, or they just like to please. And a lot of us know what it's like to get a stubborn one that's self-willed. What I want to encourage you to do is not to develop the attitude, Oh, no! Why can't that one be like this one? You know, that one's messed up. The one that's strong-willed, you're going to have to correct that selfish stubbornness. That's your job, Mom. That's your job, Dad. But what I want to suggest to you, you've got to train this one, too. This is two ends of a spectrum. They both have their potential good and their potential evil. I want you to think about how God created things. God is creator. The devil is perverter. What God created is good. Okay? We can use it for good or evil. If you go through the lists of the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, what are almost every one of those? A perversion of something good. What's idolatry? A perversion of something good. Worship. What's fornication and adultery? A perversion of something good. Hatred. Did God make us with the ability to hate? Is there a place for hatred? The Bible said, abhor what is wicked. Cleave to what is good. There's a place for jealousy. Isn't there? Our God is a jealous God. If you come home and your spouse says, I'm leaving you for the mailman, how should you feel? Jealous. If your neighbor gets a Mercedes, how should you not feel? Jealous. One is your business, the other isn't. One is something is taken that is bound by God to you, the other isn't. There's a right place for it and a wrong place for it. There's a place for a desire to please, and there's a place for independence and backbone. And the best people have both. And whichever child you have, if you've got one at one end of the spectrum or the other, you need to help them to have the other end. Let me illustrate. My daughter April was a fairly easy child and liked to please and liked to do things. Just a good girl. Good girl. One day, we had a family over, and they had a little boy that was a stinker. And I would not be surprised for him to misbehave, but I would have been very surprised to see my daughter misbehave. Well, I walked back into the house, and there was little Mr. Stinker with a pen just writing on the wall. And guess who's right beside him? My daughter, writing on the wall. If you're a pleaser, what do you like to do? Please people. And so if you have a child who just, I'll be glad to do that. I'll do that. If you never develop some backbone in that child, when they get, they're invited to a party, oh, come to this party. Okay. There's a line of cocaine. Okay. There's a lot of people. Have you ever known people in the church who are wonderful at encouraging and exhorting, and just everybody likes them. Everybody likes them because they're so sweet and kind-hearted. But when somebody needs to be spoken to, when somebody needs to be corrected, when somebody needs to be rebuked, when somebody's doing something wrong, oh, I couldn't say anything to them. Oh. Why? I don't like confrontation. I don't want anybody to not like me. This person needs a little bit of what? Need some backbone. You ever had people in the church? I'll talk to him. You know, they're happy to. You know, I don't mind. I'm itching for a fight. You know, well, that person may need to learn something about, you know, pleasing. If you've got a child that's strong-willed, you got your hands full. You don't have to take away that selfishness. But if you can take away that selfishness and let remain a backbone that will stand for what is right no matter who else does not. They don't care. But everybody else says you ought to do this. I don't care. It's not right. I'm not going to do it. That backbone is a valuable thing. I don't know what Barnabas and Paul were like as children. But I want you to think about their two personalities. And this one over here, I suspect that a lot of the heroes and generals in history were probably strong-willed kids. Can you see how that's probably the case? Paul and Barnabas, think about their personalities. Do you suppose Paul, as a child, was independent and strong-willed, or just a pleaser and goes along with what everybody ever wanted? How about Barnabas? I don't know. But I love Barnabas. We need Barnabases. We need Pauls. But the one time we see Barnabas mess up is when? Barnabas is always encouraging people. When other, here comes Paul, oh, I believe you, I believe you. Let's take John Mark. No, let's not take John Mark. Oh, let's give him another chance. He's a very encouraging, very kind-hearted person. Very, son of exhortation, they name him. But when he's eating with some Gentiles and Peter's with him, but then some other guys from Jerusalem come and Peter stops eating with the Gentiles, what does Barnabas do? Went right along with Peter. What does Paul do? Sounds like all alone stood up and said, that's not right. So whichever you get, and a lot of children are going to be somewhere in the middle. Help them to have a backbone. With some, that comes pretty natural. And you just got to get that backbone to stand for God, not selfishness. With some, they need to be taught to please people. With some, that just comes natural. With some, you're going to need to teach it, you know, to think about other people's feelings. But if you have one that's extreme one way or the other, be thankful of the gift that they want to please. You won't have to train that as much, but they need to have a backbone. And if they've got backbone, appreciate that they've got backbone and train them to subject it to Almighty God and to think about other people's feelings. Thank you for your attention. Selfish stubbornness needs to be broken, but principled independence is very valuable. When, and if you got one of those, when and your child wins. Take the time, teach them to do right, train them to do right, expect them to do right. Train up a child in the way that he should go so that when he is old, he will not depart from it. Let us not let the devil have our children. Let's have holy lives. Let's have righteous, joyous, happy homes. And let's raise children that understand they're not going to get everything everybody else gets, but they're going to stand for God. And let them enjoy the blessings of it. Amen. If you're subject to invitation in any way, won't you come as you stand and sing?